This is the fourth tape in a series by Thomas B. Taylor, Associate Professor of Church History and Old Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
Thus far in Ecclesiastes, we've occupied ourselves with the matters introductory to the book, as well as with the major discourses of it. Our discussion saw Ecclesiastes broken down into four major discourses, beginning with a little prologue and concluding with an epilogue. In those discourses, the writer set forth his views of life in a powerful and expressive way. In the first of those discourses, which went through the end of chapter 2, he talked about the basic facts of life and emphasized the truth that if they were not accepted, there could be no progress. In the second of those discourses, which went on fairly much through the end of chapter 6, the writer talked about the quality of life as lived before man and God. He emphasized that God has given us life to enjoy, and it is ours to enjoy, but only as long as we live it in the light of God. In the third of the discourses, the writer proceeded to discuss those things that we refer to as life views, and his point was that our view of life must be brought into agreement with the Lord. And then in the fourth of the discourses, the writer talked about advice that would guide us in old age or as our life goes on, his emphasis being that we would need to remember our Creator and to keep our morale and mind fixed upon Him. So contrary to what is sometimes said of Ecclesiastes, it is a book about life and a book about living. It does not say much about the next world, but it talks a lot about this world and in particular tries to get us to have our focus in this world sharp on the things that it ought to really be sharp on. So when we take Ecclesiastes on a chapter-by-chapter, verse-by-verse basis, that's something that we come up with. Four discourses introduced quickly by the concept that everything is vain without the knowledge of God and concluded with the same thrust. The ultimate conclusion is simple, that the only thing that is really worthwhile is honoring God and doing what He says. Everything else becomes a secondary issue. Now in our study of Ecclesiastes, we proposed originally to do two things. First, to look at the book on this section-by-section segment, and then to go back and talk about some of the themes in Ecclesiastes that are repeated over and over again. And that we propose now to do by citing, in particular, four of those themes. They are the items that show up in Ecclesiastes as the way in which people try to make their lives and try to make their lives go for good. The particular things we'll mention are not bad in themselves, but the writer in Ecclesiastes will want us to know that they cannot be the aim of life, nor can they be the end of the life, with any meaningful sort of fulfillment. In other words, friend, Ecclesiastes is a book about living, but the emphasis is living with real values, living with real standards, living with things that really mean something. And in order that we might know some of the things that don't mean anything, the writer is often very negative on particular points that are sometimes thought to be very meaningful to us. In connection with each of these four themes, taking them one at a time, I will mention the particular scriptures that relate to them, and then I will discuss the theme, going to the particular scripture passages as they are needful and important to us. The first theme in Ecclesiastes is kind of an interesting one for a seminary professor to discuss. It's what I refer to as the failure of education. Now, when I say it's the first theme, I mean that it shows up in the book before anything else shows up. I don't mean that it's the most important one, but it shows up in the book very quickly when the writer tells us how he sought to know everything that he possibly could, but that the more he knew, the more miserable he happened to be. In a nutshell, the failure of education is this. It merely makes our lives full of frustration. Now, I'm not anti-education, because education is my forte, and it's how I make my living. That is, it's how I attempt to do that. I believe in going to school. School has been a big part of my life. But if one thinks that knowing more is what gives him ultimate meaning in existence, Koheleth says that is not true. Education fails. Education in itself doesn't really make your life any better. A friend of mine and I once were fishing, and we watched in a field near us a man who was obviously not possessed of very good mental faculties. He obviously was not possessed of good mental faculties. We were casting fly lines in a trout stream. He had taken a piece of wood and tied a long string on it and was standing in the middle of the field snapping the string back and forth and laughing wildly to himself. My friend said, "Isn't that too bad?" He said, "A man like that." And I said, "I don't know if he's worse off than we are or not. I said, we've been throwing a string back and forth in the creek all day. I said, we've been irritated with the fish. We've been condemning the weather. We've been thinking that God made fish smarter than we were. I said, we are the normal persons, but we've been bothered all day. I said, he stands in the field shaking a string back and forth and laughs and enjoys himself. Now, that probably is a poor comparison, but what I'm saying is that what we knew was making us miserable, and what he didn't know was leaving him be perfectly happy in the course of life. So the failure of education is that no matter how wise you become or how much you try to study or learn, that will never complete your life and never satisfy your soul. The main passages in which this is discussed in Ecclesiastes come in this order. First of all, in Ecclesiastes 1, verses 12 through 18. I'm not going to read the passages on the tape, but I thought I should mention what they are. Ecclesiastes 1, verses 12 through 18. Here the writer tells us that he was the king over Israel in Jerusalem. And he tells us that he gave his heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all the things that are done under heaven. He looked to find them out. Eventually, in verse 16, he will tell us that he had great experience of wisdom and great knowledge. He put his whole heart to knowing it in verse 17. His conclusion in verse 18 is simple. In much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. When we were talking about that on a verse-by-verse basis, I tried to emphasize that he was not opposed to wisdom, but he was simply saying that wisdom does not satisfy the need of the heart. Knowledge does not meet the need of the inner man. You simply know more things that make you uncomfortable and more things that make you miserable. The second passage of Scripture that takes up the doctrine or the teaching of the failure of education is in Ecclesiastes 2, in particular verses 12 through 17. I'm selecting what I regard as the major portions, but Ecclesiastes 2, verses 12 through 17. In this passage, the writer looks at wisdom and madness and folly. He knows that wisdom exceeds folly. He knows that. He knows that it's far better to be wise than it is to be dumb. But at the same time, in knowing that, he knows that the wise man will die exactly like the fool. His wisdom has only made him more frustrated in his scope of life. I don't want to be negative about that, but it's a rather big point. I'm a wise man, he said. I know more than all those round about me. But what is my end? I will die like the fool. Now, he doesn't mean that he and the fool will have identical deaths, that they'll be in the same bed in the nursing home or anything like that. But he means that he has no more control over his total destiny for being a wise man than a fool does. And his wisdom makes him unhappy. Just knowing that makes him unhappy. It's not easy to illustrate that, I think. But from time to time, we'll look around and see somebody who just lives a terribly casual existence. You get almost disgusted with the casual, unthinking way they live. And then suddenly you realize that maybe in the long run, they will be no worse off than you are with all of your careful planning and all of your careful scheming and all of the things that go with it. The more you know, says the writer, the more miserable you're likely to be. The third passage is found in Ecclesiastes 7, 7 verses 19 through 29. And in this particular passage, he talks about wisdom strengthening the city and how there's no just man that does good. It's good to be wise, but one sinner can destroy a lot of the good things that people do. We are warned that we shouldn't be bothered in verse 21 when people curse us, because we ought to remember how we've cursed others in our heart too. But the end of our wisdom is to tell us that others will curse us like we've cursed others, that others will not do things just as we did not do them. Wisdom will show us the emptiness of our own efforts and our own ambitions. Now, I have to stop and repeat what I said several times. The writer is not opposed to education and learning, neither am I. But it cannot be an end of life in itself, because in the first place, it merely shows you the things you can't do anything about. In the second place, it merely shows you that death is the consequential end of the wise and the fools at the same time. And in the third place, it demonstrates that it is often frustrated by the silliness of people that aren't wise. The wisest work by the smartest man in the world can be frustrated by one fool that goes in and muddles the whole thing up. I've had a cousin for years who worked repairing computers. He was working on a very large computer some years ago and stopped by my house on the weekends to talk about it. I know nothing about that sort of thing. So I was always interested in hearing what he had to say. And he said, well, he said, the men who designed this computer were brilliant men. They were brilliant men. He said, the men who laid out the programs, they were brilliant men. But, he said, the man who connected the power source was a fool, he said. Now, I don't know all the details of computers, and I'd hate to be pressed into details trying to explain what he meant, except this was what he was saying. One man had made a few wrong electrical connections, and the whole machine was destroyed when circuits blew up. Well, they were able to rebuild a great deal of it. But what he was saying was that there was a brilliant designer, a brilliant engineer, a brilliant thinker, but somebody who didn't know where to squeeze the pliers. And one person's folly ruined the wisdom of many, many others. So, just knowing that makes you feel ill at ease. A friend of mine recently took pictures for a wedding. He's a brilliant photographer. They were going to be brilliant pictures. The proofs came back. Brilliant proofs and all that sort of thing. Sent off for the actual prints and negatives. Everything was lost in the mail. It may show up tomorrow, but everything was lost in the mail. And consequently, he said to me, every time I mail out a film, he said, I worry what will happen to it before it comes back. Now, if he were really stupid, he would know that films got lost. He could be spared all of that difficulty. But the wise man in chapter 7 knows that things don't go equitably in life as far as we can see, and his knowledge makes him more miserable. The fourth of these passages is in chapter 8, verses 16 and 17, where the writer tells us how he put his heart to wisdom and to see all the things that were done under the earth, but he found out that he could not know all the things that were done by God. No matter how hard he labored to work, he couldn't know enough. And the end of all of his study was to make him feel ignorant by what he didn't know. I've often said in seminary teaching, you have to take it with a grain of salt, I think, but I've often said that the most dangerous preacher in the world was a chap who had 1 year of Greek. He knows just enough to make big statements that he can neither check, confirm, or qualify, and can simply read commentaries. I've sometimes said that the only person who was more dangerous than he was a person who only had 6 weeks of Greek. By the time a person has studied Greek for 2 years, he knows some Greek, and he knows a lot of things that he can't say definitely. By the time he has become a classical authority, getting a PhD in Greek literature, he suddenly begins to realize that there are millions of points about Greek that he will never know. And that brings him back into comparative reality. We've often chuckled at two preacher friends of mine, one of whom has had enough Greek to be able to read slightly, but the other of whom has a PhD in comparative linguistics, majoring in ancient languages. He can read Greek standing on his head in the bathtub. The first of them, with a smattering of Greek, quotes it all the time in his preaching. The second man makes no reference to it whatsoever. He shows the fruit of it, but makes no reference to it. The difference is a matter of knowledge. He has learned that the deeper your study, the more humble you need to conduct yourself. Now, when you can accept that, then you can be happy. But many times, with that revelation of wisdom, one can't accept it, and one is turned into a very anguished person internally. The fifth passage is found in chapter 9, in verses 13 through 18. Chapter 9, verses 13 through 18 is the account of the man with the wisdom who saved the city. I've commented on this passage a number of other times before in our discussions, and I hate to repeat it here, but here's the wise man who saves the city. He knows that he will not be remembered. Wisdom teaches you that you will very often not get what you want in life. And so when you put all the passages together, when you put them all together, what you come up with is the rather striking concept that wisdom will not fulfill your life. It's more likely to make you a victim of circumstance than in almost anything else or in any other way. Now let me pause there, having mentioned the five major passages. Let me pause there and define a couple of terms. We like to say that knowledge is everything in life that's made some meaningful impression on you. Your knowledge are the things that have made some meaningful impression on you. You touch the stove, you remember it was hot, you don't touch it again. You now have knowledge, that is, that a hot stove will burn you. Learning, we say, is the process of acquiring new and meaningful impressions. On the basis of what you know, you go out and pick up other things that have meaningful impressions. Wisdom, then, is the ability to take both what you know and what you learn and to apply it in the circumstance of life. So Koheleth says, here's what I did. I gained all the knowledge, all the meaningful and powers of perception that I could. I gained all the knowledge that was available to me. He tells us that in chapter 1. I did not stop with that. I continued in a learning process to add to it regularly all that I could find out of the work of God. And not only did I seek to have the meaningful perceptions in my mind, and not only did I seek to increase their number, but I also was able to apply them to life cycles. So first of all, he was enormously knowledgeable. Second, he was brilliant in his learning. And third, he was enormously wise in his application of those things. As we say in our modern culture, he had it put all together. I knew a brilliant chap once. We used to say that he was brilliant, and academically he was at the top of his order. But we used to say that if you left him alone on a desert island with cases of canned food and three can openers, he would starve to death before he figured out how to work the can opener. He was knowledgeable and had the practice of learning, but he could not apply what he knew to the existing problems of life. Koheleth is not like that. He can do it all. He can take what he knows and add to it what he can learn, and then apply it in a way that no man could. The degree of that fulfillment is found in a number of places in the framework of the book. We find in chapter 1 and verse 16 that he was wiser than all those who were around him in the city of Jerusalem. He knew more and was better able to apply it than anybody else. There's a striking reference in chapter 2 and verse 3, where he tells us how he gave his heart to wine, but he was able to keep his head just the same. He was wise enough to keep his head even when he was having fun. He was wise enough in 7:25 to know people and know how they react. He's wise enough to see that learning is superior to force and that wisdom is superior to money or any other thing you can name. He's wise enough to know all of those things. Well, you'd think a man that would know those things would be complete in himself. You'd think he'd have satisfaction and blessing. That's what you'd think. You'd think that the man who can sit down and get all A's on the examination, you'd think the man whose IQ has to be measured with with some super measuring stick, you'd think he'd be happy in what he has, but he's not. The result of it, all of his learning and all of his training, the result of it is summarized in verse 18, chapter 1. In much wisdom there's much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increases sorrow. The same thing is seen in chapter 2 in verses 16 and 17. The wise man dies like the fool. And in 7:23 and 24, the same thing is seen. I said, I'll be wise. It was far from me. That which is far off and exceeding deep, who can find it out? The answer rhetorically is nobody. The result of his knowing so much was that he realized actually that he didn't know a fraction of what could be known in the universe. And what he did know simply made him unhappy. Once I found some berries on a property where I used to work in Philadelphia. In this part of the world, we call them wine berries. But at the time, I didn't know what they were. I think they're in the raspberry family. They grow in a husk. When the husk opens, the berry is ripe. They have a kind of a tart, lemony taste. I didn't know what they were. I'd never seen them before, but I was eating one. They tasted good. A friend came by, and he said, what is that? I said, I don't know what it is, but I said, I'm eating it. It tasted good. He said, how do you know it's not poisonous? I said, I don't know that it's not poisonous, I said. But I said, I see the birds eating them. And I said, anything that a bird eats, I can eat. Now, that was a stupid thing to say, but I said it. And he looked at me and he said, have you ever seen the cardinals in the winter eating the berries off the bittersweet bush? Now, the bittersweet is poisonous, and those berries would curl your hair in less time than it takes to tell. But the cardinals eat them with impunity. Now, when he told me that, suddenly I felt sick. I'd already eaten about a box of wine berries just working around the grounds. To relax, I didn't get sick. I discovered they are good to eat. I learned it on botanical basis. But when he told me that, suddenly I felt sick. He had brought a piece of knowledge to my mind that revealed to me the fallacy of all that I knew before. And I wondered how long it would be till my wife had to call for the undertaker. And if she'd remember that I'm qualified to be buried in a veteran cemetery. Well, says Koheleth, the result of knowing all these things is that I'm miserable by my knowledge. Now that misery is produced by the fact that it has shown him his own inability, the knowledge has. It's shown him his own inability to control his world force, to control his destiny, to control a lot of the circumstances round about him. That's what we see in chapter 1. When he tells us that there are too many things made crooked to make them straight, that there are too many things out of joint to ever bring them back in line. The particular references are in chapter 1 and verses 14 and 15. His wisdom only strengthens his own inability and makes him look insecure. But worse than that, in chapter 2, all that wisdom and all that learning merely reminds us of our own transiency. Transiency meaning that we are here today and gone tomorrow. Do you remember what it was like when you were in school? Do you remember how long ago it was? Now, here's the funny thing. You'd be just as old if you'd never gone to school. Maybe you would seem older for all I know. But school becomes a measurement, a yardstick, a measurement. You look back and you say, I went 8 years, I went 4 years, I went 4 years, I went 6 years. It becomes a measurement that marks off your life. And as some wag once said, by the time you get old enough to know what you want to do, you're too old to be able to do it. The whole education process reminds us in a forceful way of our transiency and the way in which we pass. In addition to that, all of this learning and all of this education, in addition to that, it seeks to remind us that there's no guarantee we'll be accepted in our society for what we are or for what we want to be. You may be a wise man, your society may think you're a fool. I suppose it might be true otherwise, too. You might be a fool and your society might think you're a wise man, but there's no guarantee that you'll be accepted along the way that you want to see it. And likewise, wisdom reminds us that we don't always receive the due reward that we think ought to be ours while we're here. There's hardly a day goes by in our area of the world where you don't read about somebody striking or revolting or arguing over salary conditions. I'm not saying whether they are right or wrong to do so. I'm simply saying that that's the way it is. They want what is coming to them. But we all do that to a degree. But wisdom looks and teaches us that in life we may never get the reward that is really ours. Met a chap once who told me that he was the real inventor of a particularly ingenious machine. The man who patented it has made millions on it. This chap said to me, grouchily, he said, I was the real inventor of it, but he said, I made a mistake and let this other man see it, and he patented it, and he said, he's made millions, and I'm still poor. I'm not laughing at him. Guess it's not really funny. I'm not even sure that he was telling me the truth. People say things like that. But whatever the case happens to be, wisdom teaches us that you may not get the reward that you really think ought to be yours. Now, there are some positive things for education in Ecclesiastes. I ought to mention them. There are some positive things. In Ecclesiastes 7:12, wisdom does give life to the man who possesses it. It lets him avoid certain mistakes. It lets him avoid certain pitfalls. It helps him to bear himself correctly. And in chapter 12, in verses 8 and 9, if we learn from what the writer sets down for us, then wisdom orders a correct path of life and gives us an understanding of life. And in chapter 12, verse 13, wisdom will direct us back to our Creator. That's a wisdom that comes from above, not the wisdom from below spoken of by James in an offhand sense, but the wisdom that comes from above. But you see, the wisdom that gives life and the wisdom that gives order is wisdom that's created with the words and the truths that the Creator has given. And I have to be in step with those words before I can provide by them. Now, the failure of education is just this. If in all your learning you neglect to make God the source of truth and center of it, learning, education, knowledge will not satisfy you. It only makes us more miserable. If God is not the center of it, it only increases our misery because it shows us our helplessness and our destitute nature in a way that fools never know anything about at all. Now, if when it shows us those things, we turn to Christ and turn to God, then I suppose it would be very helpful to us. But many times when people pursue education for education's sake, they simply push that path without regard to any other alternate and simply get further and further from that which is right. And so education fails to make a full life. No, I don't think it's wrong to go to school. I think it's good. I think it's good to get all of the education that you can possibly have. I sat in a study group years ago in which the man speaking to the group was Dr. Ironside. He was at that time pastor of the Moody Memorial Church in Chicago, Illinois. And one of these men commenting on Dr. Ironside and speaking ill of his education, he said, Dr. Ironside, he said, you have a great church. And he said, you began to preach when you were 12 or 13 years old. He said, you never went to school at all. He said, what do you think we fellows ought to do? Now, I can't remember Dr. Ironside's words word for word, but this is what he said. He said, you're right. He said, I felt a burden to preach. He said, I went to preach when I was a very young boy. And he said, I've preached all my life. But he said, I want to tell you, young men, he said, that there were some things that it took me 30 years to learn that I could have learned in 2 good years of a Bible school, he said. And he said, I've never thought it was any credit to me that I never went to school. He said, I wish that I could have gone. And then looking at us, he said, and you men have the opportunity, he said, you ought to be doing your best. No, we're not opposed to education. But if you think an increase of knowledge will solve your problems and fill your life, you're wrong. The only thing that will do that is God. The only person who will make your soul whole is the Lord. In one of my education courses years ago, we picked up a quote from Thaddeus Stevens, the Pennsylvania educator. I've looked for the source of it and haven't been able to find it. It's in my education notes, but I haven't been able to find where Stevens really said it. But my education professor said that Thaddeus Stevens said, in a slogan speech, fill the schools and empty the jails. I don't know if Stevens really said that or not. That's what I picked up in my notes in the education course. But if he said it, it only describes how incorrect men are when they view education. Train a crook and give him an excellent education. It just makes him harder to catch, that's all. Education will not satisfy the soul, will not fill a life with good. Only God can do that. That's the first theme in Ecclesiastes, the failure of education. Now the second theme, I will go back, as I said a moment ago, and look at some of the scriptures that accompany it. The second theme is what I like to refer to as the emptiness of things. I guess if we called the first one the failure of education, we could call the second one the failure of materialism. I'm not terribly good at titles on those things, but that's what it boils down to. The writer will take several verses and a few points to show us that all the things that we work so hard to get in life are really not meaningful to us ultimately, and that our possessions in the long run become less of a help to us and more of a handicap. No, I am not against possessions either, just like I'm not against education. I'm not against possessions. But if they become the goal of your life, you are doomed for despair. The first Bible passage in which the emptiness of things is discussed in detail is in Ecclesiastes 2 in verses 1 through 11. Ecclesiastes 2, verses 1 through 11. I will not read the passage again, I think, but this is the passage where Solomon talks about all the things that he had, or the writer. I assume a Solomonic authorship, but as I mentioned in the earlier introduction, some scholars disagree. But here he talks about all the things that he has, the great works that he has, the vineyards, the gardens, the pools, the maids, the servants, the treasure, the goods, the golds, the musicians. He doesn't mention automobiles, of course. They haven't been invented yet. But of his day and age, there's nothing that's material in abundance that he does not have a lot of it. He's able to tell us in verse 10 that whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I allowed myself to have anything that I wanted. He was richer than all. He was wiser than all. He had strength greater than all. Anything that he wanted, he allowed himself to have. Isn't that striking? And wouldn't you like to be there just for a few moments? Wouldn't you really like to be just at the position for a few moments that anything you wanted, you could have? Well, it would take a few minutes to get it, but you could get it. Anything you wanted, you could have, or you could get. Wouldn't you like to be there just for a few moments? Oh, most people think if they could be there for a few moments, it would make the difference in night and day. That would make their lives complete and make them healthy and make them well if they just had more. But the writer will tell us that things are awfully empty, and that you can have all of these things. And then you can say with the writer in Ecclesiastes 2:11, I looked on all of them, and it was vanity and vexation, and there was no profit under the sun. So the first passage dealing with the emptiness of things is Ecclesiastes 2, verses 1 through 11. The second passage is Ecclesiastes 4, verses 7 and 8. Ecclesiastes 4, verses 7 and 8. The writer is looking around at the events of men in this life. So he says, I stopped and I looked at all the empty things that are done under the sun. And here's one case I saw, he said. He said, I see somebody who lives alone. He has nobody to support, nobody to care for. He doesn't have a child and he doesn't have a brother. He's all by himself. And yet he works endlessly at his labor. His eye is not satisfied with what he has. He can't tell who he works for and he can't tell why he does it. Why does he put himself to the torture of anguish and hard? Why? Well, he doesn't know why. He's getting things in great abundance. He's got nobody to leave it to. He's got nobody to share it with. He's got nobody to support with it. But he continues to pile it up in great abundance. And what is the end result of that? To have nothing. Only a pile of junk for somebody to sell at an auction when you're gone, I suppose. Will those things make his life complete? No, they won't make his life complete. They will leave him with nothing and nothing to show. The third passage is in Ecclesiastes 5 at verse 9 through verse 17. Ecclesiastes 5, verses 9 through 17. The writer begins by telling us that the one who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver. He also tells us that when goods increase, the people that use them are increased too. So if you get a lot more, you won't have it to spend on yourself. Somebody else will show up and need it. He reminds us that riches are often ruined by an evil work. And that as people came forth naked when they were born, that's how they will go when they die. Ecclesiastes 5:15 sets the background for the picture of godliness and contentment that's found in 1 Timothy chapter 6. They will go out as empty as they came in, he said. Because they bring in nothing with them, they can take nothing, and all the days that they live and eat, they move in darkness with sorrow and wrath and sickness. That's really a kind of a morbid way to put it. But morbid or not, the writer is saying, just look at things. You came with nothing and you will go with nothing. Not saying that it's wrong to have a few things, but you came with nothing, you will go with nothing. Hence, if your mind is on things, the moment comes when you leave it all behind. I think that a person ought to take care of their properties when the Lord lets them have something. I believe that good stewardship suggests we take care of it. But you look at the man with the new automobile. Watch him when he gets the first scratch on one of those bright fenders. For about 9 men out of 10, it looks like the world has ended. That new automobile is his whole life, his whole circumstance. I was at the home of friends on a Sunday some years ago. They had a big, expensive automobile. It shone like a diamond. They'd had it for 60 miles. Riding into the yard in the tricycle came the little girl. She ran along the side of that thing and scraped an unbelievable gouge in the paint with the wheel on her bicycle. The father went out and looked at it. Then he looked at her and he said, "You scraped a car." And she said, "I'm sorry, Daddy." And he said, "Well," he said, "we can probably get it painted." And he walked away and said nothing else. Words to that effect. And I said to him, "That's good." I said, "Lots of men really get excited when it's a car that's scratched." "Well," he said, "I don't want to ruin my car," but he said, "that is my daughter." He said, "That's my daughter." And he said, "Part of the risk of being a parent is that the children may do things that hurt some of the things you have." He said, "My children are more important than my things." I thought that was a beautiful sentiment. But it is also a rare one. Too many people are gripped by their things to the abnegation of the people round about them. And so Solomon says, the man who wants to get silver will never be contented with silver. The more he gets, the more uses there will be for it. He will need more and more of it, and things will leave him empty in the long run. The fourth passage is in Ecclesiastes 10, verses 1 through 11. Ecclesiastes 10, verses 1 through 11. Here the writer tells us how a little folly ruins a person's good reputation. It doesn't take very much. It tells us about the things that we have, and the way that we live, and the way that we move among ourselves. Tells us that we have to learn to work with the things that we have, the iron, the stone, the wood. We have to learn to work with those things if we are going to achieve anything. Wisdom is profitable to direct us in those things. But the things which we possess in ourselves are easily ruined by a little folly, a little dullness, a little evil in the wrong places, a little graft of the right judge, and many of your good things can be lost to you. And so things do not make life complete. Now, in talking about things and the emptiness of them, it's important that we note two or three matters. First of all, Koheleth is not condemning the ownership of property or wealth and gain. He's not condemning that. He's simply saying that that isn't what makes life. If that made life, he says, I would have had it because nobody had as much of the things that I had. But it doesn't make life. It's not a condemnation of ownership. It's kind of a judgment on what the value systems are that we go by. At the same time, in the emptiness of things, the possessions do not become a gauge for judging the lives of others. You don't look around and say, well, there's somebody that's got a lot of stuff. He must be very worldly minded. God allows some people to have a lot of things. Don't assume that somebody's happy because they have a lot. Don't assume that they're unhappy because they don't have a lot. The amount of material possessions that one possesses is a very relative thing. It's not a criteria for happiness or usefulness or service to God. I think what we can say, on a more positive note, is that things in themselves and without God are worthless. That's the positive avowal. Without God, things in themselves are worthless. They can't keep you here. They can't really enrich you very much while you are here. They cannot do away with the pain and the anguish that comes when we plot on how life will be when we're not here. So in that capacity, they do not mean a great deal. Now let's think for a moment about all that Solomon possessed. I mentioned in chapter 2 the many things that were his. But those things, homes and lands and fields and luxuries of life, material wealth, those things did not make him happy. Entertainment, fulfillment, they made him not happy. Why not? Well, because it takes godliness along with contentment to produce great gain. Everything for him was vanity and vexation of spirit because he never came to the point with those things where he could stop. He never got to the point where he could say, I've got it all now, that's it. As long as there's a universe round about us, our greedy natures cry out for more and more things. And the things move us with vanity. I've had a little fishing boat for some years. It's a little one. You could almost take it in the bathtub at night and play with it. But I occasionally go out in a small lake with it. It's a little one. I've wanted a motor for it. The only motor I have for it is the one that the Lord gave me with my arms and shoulders. But I've wanted a motor for it. I've said to myself that a 3-horsepower, 2.6 horsepower, 5, any one of those motors would run it. And I don't happen to have one at this particular time. I'd go out with oars. But I can see what would happen. I get a motor. For the sake of argument, a 5-horsepower motor. I really move down the lake in this little boat. And somebody says, you ought to have a bigger boat to go with that motor. So I want a bigger boat. And the next thing you know, somebody says, you ought to have a bigger motor to go with that bigger boat. Before long, you want a yacht. And then you find yourself looking covetously at the Queen Elizabeth. I know that's absurd. But that's exactly the way it is with the things that we possess. They are vanity and vexation of spirit because you never come to the point where that's just it. Now, you may have. I mean, the natural man without wisdom from God, without understanding, doesn't. And many of us labor with that, too. Many of us have already got possessions and goods beyond any reasonable amount. And yet, one will come out in a sale catalog from the Snookville store next week. And you'll want to have it, even though you may have 3 things that already do all that that thing does. Do you remember the old pushing lawnmowers? They had a wheel on each end and a reel in the middle, and you pushed them and the reel went round and it cut your grass. Do you remember those? When I was a boy, I mowed a lawn of over an acre with one of those things. I just went out and did it. There was nothing else to do. If I hadn't done it, it's hard to tell what response I might have gotten. I did it. I mowed a lot of people's lawns in the country where we lived with a thing like that. Just got out and pushed it. Well, it isn't very long, you see, till you want a power mower. One that runs the mower. And then you want a power mower that runs itself. And then you want a power mower that you can sit on. And then a power mower with an umbrella to keep the shade off your head. And very likely in a little while, a power mower with an automatic lemonade dispenser so that you can work in maximum comfort. Absurd? Oh, yes, but that's the problem with things. They will leave you empty, for there's never enough. The time never comes when things in themselves satisfy us. Things tend to make our lives miserable, too, because every time we look at them, we're reminded that we're dying and we'll have to leave them all. Have to leave them all. I have a rather nice collection of books on the life of Lincoln. Not hundreds, but quite a few. Many of them came from an uncle's collection. I've augmented it just a little bit. Like to read about Lincoln and Washington, and so I have a couple hundred books, I suppose, all together in that subject. Thousands have been written, so mine is not neat, but it's a nice library. Every now and then I find myself at my study, I look up at it, and I say, I wonder what will happen to my Lincoln books when I'm gone. Will they go back to the goodwill? I wonder what will happen to my Lincoln books. And you know, if you're not careful, you can allow your material possessions to make you very morbid along those lines. They're not dying. We're dying. And our material goods, as we learn in chapter 2 and verses 19 and 21, among other places, our material goods have got to be left to somebody else who may not even take care of them. I've often thought of my grandfather's Hudson automobile. He bought a new Hudson automobile in 1941. When he died, he gave it to a member of the family. He thought it would run till the millennium, I suppose. He gave it to a member of the family. In due time, it didn't run well, it didn't run hardly at all, and like good farmers, we parked it out in the field and let it sit there till nature would return it to the environment. I used to pass that rusty hulk and say to myself, what would my grandfather think if he knew how his automobile was rusting? That's what material goods do to us. So in a nutshell, things never satisfy us. They don't have the potential to make life complete. They don't satisfy us for the moment. They show us our transiency, and they give us a lot to worry about who's going to steal them or take them or ruin them or what's going to happen to them. Now, in Ecclesiastes, the writer doesn't just leave us up in the air saying, well, don't have anything. No, on the contrary. He will allow us to have a lot. He tells us in Ecclesiastes 5 in verses 18 and 20 that it's good to receive of our labor and to take what we have in the way of things as from God. Good to receive it as from God. It's good to accept the possession that we have as God's gifts, and the ones that we are seeking to have, to see them as coming from God, to accept them as being a kind of a divine trust, God trusting us with them. And then we can accept them with the providence of God foremost in our mind. And we don't have to think about the hard times and the difficult times. We can think about the way God has blessed us, not only in our souls, but materially as well. And if we allow the reality of these things to draw us back to God who gave them, then the things possess some reality to us. And, along with other good points, the things sometimes challenge us to harder work and to greater exercise and to greater diligence, as in Ecclesiastes 9, 8 through 10. They move us on to greater diligence and greater energies in making sure that our time is well spent. Well, here's the thrust, friends, of this theme in Ecclesiastes. The writer says, if you think by having a lot you're going to satisfy your life, you're wrong. Men strive for goods, but a man's life does not consist in the abundance of things which he possesses. So in one fell swoop, Solomon says, things will fail to give you a full life, just as much as education will not fully satisfy your soul. Those are the first two themes in Ecclesiastes. Our third theme in Ecclesiastes relates to the matter of living. I've referred to it as the frustrations of living. As I've said two or three times in our discussion, the writer is not being pessimist. He's just taking a realistic view of what life is like. And he tells us, first of all, that education will not satisfy our soul and life's ambitions. And then he tells us that things won't do it either. Neither going to school nor possessing stuff will make your life what you want it to be. Nothing wrong with education, nothing wrong with things. But they will not make your life what you want it to be. Lots of people do not need that advice, I suppose. And many who do need it will not accept it. But accept it or reject it, it's the simple result of the study of a man of God who, under the inspiration of the Spirit, tried all sorts of sources and told us all manner of truth, that we might learn not to think that education or things complete life. But, says the writer, just living isn't enough either. Living the big life, the good life, that isn't enough either. Some people think just to live, and that's the expression in some songs, let me live. The idea is let me have a big experience. Let me do big and exciting things. That's the concept with live. But the writer in Ecclesiastes will be very emphatic with us on that, that just living in itself is not that which makes life meaningful either. Men love life. Nothing wrong with that. The desire for strong preservation is one of the greatest natural impulses. And many people find themselves living only for this life itself, hoping for a better tomorrow, but never really seeing it. Their whole being is geared around a day-by-day existence in the hope that sometime they will really live, collect my Social Security, go to my home in Florida, and really live. Now, of course, when we speak of life that way, we're talking about man's physical existence. We're not talking about the life of the soul or the inner life of the being or the intellectual life, but mere physical existence. But, of course, without that mere physical existence, you can't do much else. And so to some people, the mere physical existence comes to be a domineering factor in life. They want to simply live. And Koleth will tell them in no uncertain terms that living in itself is a frustrating piece of business. There are several passages that convey this meaning to us, which I will suggest to you at this time. The first of them is in chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. Chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. Where the writer sees that many times in life there are inequities and injustices and nobody to adequately plead the cause of the downtrodden. Why, he said it would be better not to be born to live like that. Better not to be born than to live a life in which there is oppression and grief and nobody to take your side. Now he's speaking just on the basis of an observation of life as he knows it in his time. And as I will say in a few moments, when you bring the reality of God into these circumstances, a lot of things change, and a lot of things change for the better. But as he sees it for his time, there are many people oppressed and many troubled and many unfairly treated. And nobody to speak up for them. What is living to them? A means of aggravation and difficulty. I've had a friend in the hospital recently. He said kind of humorously the other night that the amount of money he had to pay for the hospital, he thought maybe he ought to buy one. It'd be cheaper to own one than it'd be to go to one. Well, the hospital's been a great blessing to him. No argument about it. But every day that he lives, he looks up and says, how am I ever going to pay for this? I'm not saying that he's wrong to live. Please don't misunderstand me on that. But mere living has become a burden, not only to him, but to many other persons too. In chapter 6, there's a striking passage in verses 1 through 8. The writer talks about the difficulty that he's seen under the sun. It's common among men. He calls it an evil. As I've mentioned before, evil is not a moral thing, but a physical problem. Here's a man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that he doesn't want anything, and yet he doesn't have the power to eat thereof. That may mean that he died in advance. It may mean that he simply has a giant ulcer and he can't take care of himself. It's vanity to have all these things of life about you and not be able to enjoy them. Likewise, in the same passage, the writer says if a man lives 100 years, you know, he lives a long time, he's got a lot of children, he has everything that he needs. Everything that he needs. But his soul is not filled with good, and he has no honorable stand before God. He says it would have been better for him if he had never been born. For life that is merely lived for yourself is disappointing and shallow. In chapter 7, verses 1 through 10, a similar passage is given. The writer tells how it's better to go to the house of death than it is to go to the house of feasting. There he's saying that when death comes, life is ended. He's not saying that we should all commit suicide. He's simply saying that when death comes, life is ended. And you know what the record is. It's over, it's established, and you can let the people rest in what they've done. But as long as we live, we are met with the frustration of fools and the anger of life and the difficulty of wondering just how things will come out in the long run. So that life under those circumstances becomes a tangle of emotion and despair. You're living, but you don't know what you're living for. Likewise in chapter 8, in verses 6 through 11, a long section, much along the same line, which the writer tells us that nobody can really tell man how his life is going to go. God knows, but only God knows. And the fact that a man is strong does not mean that he will win. The fact that a man has a spirit does not mean he'll be able to retain it. Eventually in verse 10 he says, I saw the wicked buried who had come and gone from the place of the holy. They were forgotten in the city where they had so done. The emphasis is that life has a kind of a desultory effect to it. After a while you develop a great feeling of frustration as it marches to the grave. Please remember that in Ecclesiastes the writer is not talking about your eternal destination. He's talking about the physical life that you live right now, marching to the grave. Some of us think that the Lord may come and interrupt those things for some segments of his society. But under the normal course of life, the physical life that I now live, with due apologies to Longfellow, marches to the grave. And in chapter 11, there is a final note in this particular section, verses 7 through 10. The writer tells us that the light is sweet, and it's a pleasant thing to behold it. But let a man, as he lives, let him remember that the days of darkness come. Ah, when you're full of life and vital and peppy and emotively up, you think that all of your life will be that way. But, says Coalesce, remember the days of darkness come, and there will be plenty of them. I don't know if he really means that the days of darkness will be so many, but they seem that way. It only takes one really bad day to make you forget years of good days. The days of darkness, I think, are the days of old age and the days of inability and the days of difficulty that eventually lead into our passing into the next world. But the frustration of life is that you can't stop it and keep it. The living process moves on, and we move on with it. I remember when my grandfather was dying, he surveyed his life. He's had a lot of things to say, but he surveyed his life and he said, there's hardly a thing in my life I would change if I could live the whole thing over. He said, there's hardly a thing I would change. That's quite a beautiful emotion to have when one comes to the end of life. It is also fairly uncommon. The one thing that most men would like to change is they'd like to add 10 more years of vigor and peak and potential. But that's the frustration of living. You will not be tomorrow the man that you are today. In the summer, for many years, I've spent a few weeks each summer at Bible camps with young people. I'm really not an expert at that. I have a bad disposition, in fact. But I have done it for several years and tried to honor the Lord in it. Now, here's what I've noticed. A few years ago, if they wanted to go out and take a run in the morning, I could go out and run with anybody. I wasn't a fast runner, but I could easily run 5 or 6 miles and not think a thing about it. With each passing year, I have run a little less. Now running to the dining hall from my bunk room is about as far as I care to sprint in the morning. That's a slight exaggeration, but that's the frustration of life. The frustration of living is in the fact that it is slowly ebbing away from you. And no matter how zestful you think it is, when you stop and reflect on it alone, it's passing. And there's no man, we're told in Ecclesiastes 8, that has power over the spirit to retain the spirit when it's passing. You see, the author has an interesting concept of life. He looks around. In chapter 2, at verse 23, he sees that all of his days were like sorrows. That's because he was living for living's sake. He was seeking the good life. But all of his days were sorrows. Because, of course, he couldn't continue them. He had no better immediate outcome than the fool or the bungler had. The result is that in chapter 6, he can say that an unborn child is better than a man who has lived, but not had his soul filled with good. And the end of a thing is much better than the beginning thereof. Because then at least you know how it comes and how it goes. Those things sound rather sad to us. They sound sad to me just talking about them here and thinking about what they mean. But the emphasis is that life in itself is not enough for you. You can't just stand up and say, oh, I'm alive, and that really satisfies me and thrills me. For the average person, that is not enough. There are 4 steps that make that view of life inadequate for us. The first of those is the certainty of death. I've touched on it a couple times, the certainty of death. You'll see a key biblical passage on it, Ecclesiastes 3, 16 through 22. We are going to die, the certainty of death. We often talk about that when we preach. We say that men who know they are going to die ought to believe on Christ and be prepared for meeting with God. I like to say that with great emphasis. Knowing what's ahead of us, we ought to be prepared to move through it and to move into it. But the certainty of death is one of the things that makes life a frustrating experience. Because no matter how much you enjoy it or how useful it is or how much you think you get done, the amount of time you're going to be here will suddenly in time be cut off without remedy, says the writer. It will suddenly be stopped. The certainty of death. And then in Ecclesiastes 6, where we looked a few moments ago in verses 1 and 2, along with that is the uncertainty of life. I mentioned that there are four reasons that give rise to this difficult view of life. Certainty of death is one of them. The uncertainty of life. So you actually are given everything you need, but how can you be guaranteed that you will have the power to take advantage of it? I had a friend who was left a small fortune. It was to be given to him on a particular date. I think he has it today, and I think he's using it for God. But it was to be given to him on a particular date. But when he inherited the fortune, the particular date was years and years away from when he was living then. And he said to me, he said, you know, with my luck, he said, I'll probably die 2 weeks before I get it, he said. I think he survived and came on in the inheritance, but that's the uncertainty of life. Now, that uncertainty of life makes life in itself a difficult proposition. You cannot say, I will do this or will do that tomorrow, because you don't know. But then in Ecclesiastes 9, 11, and 12, there is the iniquity of life. Life is not only certainly to end, and not only uncertain as it proceeds, but there's a certain iniquity in it too, inequity, a certain unfairness to it, a certain unevenness to it. The strong man doesn't always win the weightlifting contest. The fast man doesn't always win the race. The wise man doesn't always come out with honors. Time and circumstance move in all of those things. You naturally say to yourself, well, if I'm the best, I'll win. Not so. You might come down with appendicitis just before the contest is over. They might carry you out. You might not win. You might be won. So the inequity of life makes life a chancy proposition. And then there's the disparity of life. As we read in Ecclesiastes 9, 13, and 15, in the course of daily events, one may never get what is rightfully his. One may never get what is rightfully his. So when it's all over, you sit back and say, well, why am I living? Well, if you're only living for living's sake, that's bad. You'll be unhappy. That's why people cling to the everyday concept of one more day of life, one more day of life. If you only live for the living's sake, you will be unhappy. Because the thing that you're living for, life itself, is another one of those things you can't keep. You are a transient person moving through a very self-sustaining and self-continuing world. The end of it all, Ecclesiastes finds the writer looking at the grave with a kind of a dismal picture of it. The end is better than the start. The death is better than birth. Why? Because just in itself, life is a frustrating proposition. So frustrating that you find yourself left without strength, without energy, and without variety. Man can not only not retain the spirit, he cannot get out of the battle in which the spirit is sacrificed. He cannot be strong in the day of death, and he can't save himself by guile. Now, the frustrations of life are overcome in four simple steps. First of all, the filling of the soul with good. That's knowing the Lord and letting him be meaningful to you. Secondly, you'll find in Ecclesiastes 8, 12 through 13, trusting God for deliverance. Thirdly, rejoicing and living honorably before God. Ecclesiastes 11, 7 through 10. And fourthly, in Ecclesiastes 12, 13, and 14, remembering that God handles the accounts of life, and his accounting is an honor. The theme in Ecclesiastes is, if you are getting knowledge for knowledge's sake, if you're getting things for things' sake, if you're living for living's sake, all of those things will leave you unhappy in the end. If God is not foremost in all of them, they will have no meaning to you. Now, the fourth theme is the one that I refer to as the folly of fun, the fourth theme, the good time. The first theme relates to education. The second theme relates to possessions. The third theme relates to living. And the fourth theme relates to fun, just having a good time. And what Koheleth will tell us is that amusement in any form does not of itself satisfy the soul. I like a good time. If you mean by a good time, visiting with your friends, some laughter, some merriment, some social camaraderie, I enjoy a good time. Now, there are different ways that different people enjoy it, but I enjoy that. I like to see my friends. I like to socialize with them in a proper sort of a spirit. But Koheleth will say that if that's what you think life consists of, you're wrong. Now, in so doing, he gives us several passages of Scripture that apply. The first of them that I will note for you is Ecclesiastes 2, 1 through 3. In Ecclesiastes 2, 1 through 3, he tells us how he put his heart to seek after these things because he saw that other people liked them. I will prove you with mirth. Mirth is the one word in Ecclesiastes that sometimes has a good meaning. I'll prove you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure. That's vanity, he says. I said, of laughter, it's mad. And of mirth, what does it do? Madness is just, well, it's not insanity with a foaming mouth, but madness is just an empty-headed putting yourself after the things that you want to do. Folly is being giddy or fickle or empty-headed in your judgments. Joy is an expression of heart-centeredness. And the more that one knows of joy, the more one knows in actuality of the blessings of God in this present state. But mirth can be good or bad. Madness is always a kind of an empty-headed sort of. So the writer says, I said to my heart, here we have all these people around here laughing and being giggly and enjoying things. I said to my heart, go to now and see about these things. See what they do. Enjoy pleasure. See what it does. He said, when I saw what it does, I said, of laughter, it's mad. And mirth, what does it do? Meaning it doesn't really do very much. He acquainted himself with wine, yet kept his heart. And he soon discovered that that too was vanity and vexation of spirit. That neither a person's emotions, nor what he drank or what he ate, was enough to give him the sort of inner contentment and happiness that he actually needed in the depths of his heart. Fun, you see, is a fallacious thing. I'm using fun in the modern term of having a good time. It's a fallacious thing. Not that it's wrong in itself, but fallacious in the concept of giving meaning to life. The second passage is Ecclesiastes 6, verses 9 through 12. In these verses, the writer gets, well, just about as specific as you can be in his connection. He says, better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the soul. Better are the things you see than the things you think about. That which is named already, man has named it. You can't argue with God who gave it. The best thing, he says, for man in this life and all the days of his life is simply to see what God has done and to bask in the reality of that truth. So, it's better to sit back and say, well, the things that I can have are more important than the things that I don't have. And that would relate to your recreation, to your fun, to your enjoyment, to all the various parts of life. But to know that to absolutely prescribe the things that are best and right in every circumstance, that is far, far from us. The third passage is in Ecclesiastes 8, verse 15. I commended mirth, because a man hath no better thing under the sun than to eat and to drink and to be merry. For that shall abide with him all the labor of the days of his life which God giveth him under the sun. When you first read that, that sounds like wicked advice. That sounds like go out and have a good time and let the chips fall where they may. But the writer says, if you remember that God has given you and given these things to you under the sun, if you remember that they came from God and came from God to you, then there's nothing better than to take what God has given and use it and enjoy it and thank God for it. That, of course, is an awfully important concept. But it's not seeking fun for fun's sake, but to enjoy the reality of the gift of God and being blessed in it. And then there are a number of passages to apply. In chapter 10, I think I will not look at them in detail, but in chapter 10 and verses 1 through 7, a number that apply. But the end result is that amusement in any form does not satisfy the soul. It just doesn't do it. Now let me stop for a moment and point out that in Ecclesiastes 3, there is room for amusement in life. Some Christians, some preachers don't want you to do anything that's relaxing or amusing. If it isn't working or serving the church or getting more children for Sunday school, they think there's no room for it in life. But that's not the view of Scripture. The view of Scripture is there's a time to work and a time to play. There's a time to dance and a time not to dance. And so in the case of Ecclesiastes, we don't want to imagine that no amusement is allowed at all. Amusement, of course, means not thinking. But it doesn't mean that in a wicked sense. It means that the mind is put out of motion And one is not giving himself to a thought process. He's not laboring with his mind, not laboring with his brain. So we're not saying that all fun is wrong. What we're saying is that to make fun a goal, to make folly a goal, to make madness a goal, is to leave one unsatisfied in the scope of life. The reason for that is fairly simple. Folly and madness last only for a moment. Mirth lasts only for a few seconds. And sometimes, even in the middle of that, as we read in chapter 6, sometimes even in the middle of it, the madness, the mirth, the folly may be interrupted in trouble, and we may be put into a place of great despair because the thing that we hoped for was gone. Folly may be set in great heights, we read in Ecclesiastes 10, and people stand back in amazement of it, but suddenly it's no longer there. A laugh, I'm not sure how long it lasts, but a laugh, a good moment, a good time, lasts only a limited period of time. And nobody can keep laughing forever. Some years ago, we had a large party at the apartment that I lived in the city of Philadelphia. It was a small apartment, and the students in my seminary class came there one night for a kind of a dinner. I'm not sure what all it was. I'm not sure how we could get them all in. Maybe they weren't all there, but there were plenty of them there. The apartment was jammed. And I was feeling particularly humorous that night. I was telling stories of all sorts of things. All you have to do for a tailor is give them a small audience that appreciates stories, and the rest of the day is shot with boredom for everybody else. But I was telling stories. Some of them I made up myself. Some of them I took from others. Telling stories. And because of the emotive nature of it, it got to be one of those times when everybody was laughing. And the laughter was enormous. It was loud and long. We had trouble getting calm for devotions after a while. Lots of laughter. And then the guests went home. The next day I was up in the seminary where I was going to school. I was doing some job, and one of these guests came by, and he said, "You know," he said, "I've been feeling so sad all day." He said, "I just wanted to look you up and see if you could say something that would make me laugh." Well, I couldn't think of anything that would make him laugh at the time. But I tried to tell him that he couldn't expect me or anybody else to go around following him all the time, making wit. You can't have your own private jester in life. Life is more than fun. Laughter is but for a moment. Enjoy it while you can, but come back to the serious realities of life. A joyful spirit is a great asset. But if it is just a spirit of fun-lovingness in the physical and fleshly realms, then it won't do much for you and won't do much for others either. Now, there are four themes. They sometimes are the things that get the major emphasis in Ecclesiastes. And it's the reading of those themes that make people think that the writer has a pessimistic view of life. You can easily see how he might. He knocks education, he knocks fun, he knocks living, he knocks goods. After a while you say, what else is left? Well, of course, if all he did was critique those things, there wouldn't be much left, but he does more than just critique them. He does point out in a critical sense what's wrong with them. But he emphasizes in many passages of Scripture how those things can be corrected or how they can be made right in the scope of life. And that will bring me to my conclusion for our studies in Ecclesiastes. When the book has been studied and when the themes have been noted, the conclusion then is this, that the one thing that really counts in life is the fear of our God, the respect of our Lord. That's the one thing that really counts. Education is given meaning by knowing the Lord. Things are given meaning by knowing the Lord. Life has some fulfillment in knowing the Lord. Even fellowship and fun and recreation have a response in knowing the Lord. And there's far more of this in Ecclesiastes than many preachers envision or than many Bible readers think. Ultimately, his point is not a negative one. Ultimately, his point is enormously positive. Learn to fear and respect God, because the knowledge and respect of God is alone enduring. It fills the soul with hope. It gives the individual enough cause for living and enough activity to fill his life with good. Not only speak of God, of course, in our age, we're speaking of God the Father, we're also speaking of God the Son, even God the Spirit. But the respect of the Trinity, the respect of the Deity, is what makes life worthwhile in Koheleth, just as would be true some years later in John's Gospel. You see, when you read through all of Ecclesiastes, you discover that really everything is not wrong after all. You discover that there are many passages in which the writer gives a positive emphasis to things that are sometimes overlooked by negative readers. Let me mention just some of those. Ecclesiastes 2, 24 through 26. Very positive expression after the conclusion of his recognition of men dying, but a very positive expression. He said, there's nothing better for you than to take what God gives and to use it to honor him. God gives those things to a man. He gives them to a man that he might honor God, that he might enjoy life. Hence, there's nothing really better for you than to receive what God gives and to use it for the honor of him. In Ecclesiastes 3, verses 11 through 17, especially verses 16 and 17, there's a very moving section right after the passage that we refer to as the poem of time. In that section, why the Lord tells us, or the writer tells us of God in verse 14, that whatever he does is done forever. He does things forever. But he does it that men should stand in respect, that they should fear before him. That's why he does it. And so he says, I said in mine heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. There's a time there for every purpose and for every work. God has given these things to men that they might see themselves, and that seeing themselves, they might look to their God. Ah, the fear of God. That's the one thing that's really worthwhile. In Ecclesiastes 5, in verses 1 through 7, there's a rather lengthy section talking about how we ought to live before God. Be careful what we say before God. You ought to remember that God's on heaven, we're on earth, and our words should be few. And the writer concludes in Ecclesiastes 5, 7 with the striking statement, but fear thou God. Look up at all the things that are done round about and know that without the knowledge of God, none of them mean very much. Fear thou God. Likewise, the section in Ecclesiastes 8, 12 through 13, to which I have alluded several times, rather important segment. It shall be well with them that fear God. Those that fear before him, it shall be well. But it won't be well with the wicked because he doesn't fear God. So for those who respect God and obey him, it shall be well. But the wicked, there is no chance for him. And likewise in Ecclesiastes 11, verses 1 through 6, the reference is not so specific, but it seems plain enough, that the individual who honors what God has done for him and invests his life in a return to God, that individual is blessed in the living process. It's not the greedy man who keeps all the things he has. It's the individual who can take of his goods and sow a portion of it for the glory of God and for the blessing of God's program. Now, those particular sections in Ecclesiastes, along with the epilogue, which I talked about somewhat earlier in this series, those particular sections build that what's needed for life is the fear of God. What's needed for life is not more education. Not more education. Oh, a little more might not hurt us, but not more education, not more goods, not more fun, not more just wild living, but a definite fear of God. A respect of him, and that's needed because in Ecclesiastes 12, he is the judge of all things, and it is to him to whom our spirits return on the part of death. Yes, says the writer, fear God. That's the important thing. In the light of that, sometimes folks have said, well, how much does Koheleth, the writer of Ecclesiastes, how much does he really know about God? Well, in my analysis, I think he knows a great deal. I think he knows it personally because of his trust in the God of Israel. But you'll find a number of references throughout the book that indicate that his personal knowledge of God is quite wide. He knows, for example, in Ecclesiastes 3, 14 and 15, that God is an unchanging force in the universe. What he does it forever. He knows in Ecclesiastes 8, 12 through 13 that God is just. He knows that. He knows that God is unchanging. He knows that God is just. He knows in Ecclesiastes 5 that God requires the utmost respect of mankind because he is not limited to the earthly cycle where we're limited. That's why he says God is in heaven and you're on the earth. God is not limited in any of the ways in which you are limited. He knows that. He knows that the fear of God, the respect of God, is the one thing that pleases him in Ecclesiastes 5, 7, and other places. The one thing that pleases him. He knows that God is the true source of our good, and he thinks that we owe him thanks for all of his gifts in Ecclesiastes 5, 18, and 19. And finally, he knows that God will ask for an account of all of our doings in due time when this life is over. So actually, when you've surveyed what he knows about God, you have to conclude that he knows a great deal about God. He knows something about his person, he knows something about his work, he knows something about his expectation, and he knows something about our fellowship with him. In particular, he knows that God is good, that God is loving, and that God is considerate. In particular, he knows those things. Now, when we talk about living in respect before God, what does that mean? Well, I like to say in the language of some of the verses in Ecclesiastes that living in respect before God is living your life in these six steps. It's living it, first of all, thankfully. Ecclesiastes 2:24, thankfully. It's living it cheerfully. Ecclesiastes 9:9. It's living it honestly. Ecclesiastes 12:14. It's living it respectfully. Ecclesiastes 5:7. It's living it considerately. Ecclesiastes 11:1-6. And living it hopefully. Ecclesiastes 12:7. Sorry to rattle those off like that. But they are the aspects in which life is to be lived, in which God is to be respected. Somebody says, what does it mean to respect God? It means to live thankfully and cheerfully and honestly and respectfully and considerately and expectantly. That's what it means. It means to show in the character of our living the reality of the character of the Savior and the Mediator, and to show how His work has brought blessing to us all. That's what it means. And that becomes the driving theme in Ecclesiastes. It's really not don't study. It's really not don't have fun. It's really not don't get things. But it is fear God first. Now, man fits into this picture when he recognizes in Ecclesiastes 7:20 that he's a sinner and short of God's claim. That's what we stress so often in this gospel age, that men are sinners, we are born in sin, and that until that sin question is dealt with, we cannot know God or know the blessing of God. He's a sinner and short of God's claim. Ecclesiastes 7:20, there's no man that doth not sin that does things right. But God in Ecclesiastes 12:12 has perfected a way of instruction so that the individual can hear him and do what he wants done and enter into a life of healthy relationship with God. But man must come to God on God's terms in agreement with his particular instruction. So the big forte, you see, is living in respect of God. Eventually, the end of life will be wrapped up in a reckoning with God, Ecclesiastes 12:7 following. The material end blows to the grave. But the practical end of life is living day by day in doing what he says and honoring his word. What this means when we come to the final point is that only the knowledge of God satisfies us all. And the writer in Ecclesiastes does that by showing us how far everything else misses. Everything else that we line up, everything else that's important to us, misses it by miles. But the knowledge of God satisfies the soul. Because, you see, although Ecclesiastes doesn't say it in so many words, but you see, when we believe in Jesus, we are reunited with the Father. And we are no longer transient. We are simply persons who change form or change position, but we are part of the family, the people, the progression of the God who created all these things. And so in that sense, the knowledge of God satisfies the soul. God alone can make your labor rewarding. God alone is eternal. God alone can provide joy and blessing. And God alone is just and can establish justice for all of us. Now we've been looking at the book of Ecclesiastes, Koheleth, we sometimes say. We've been looking at it, talking about the general content about it, talking about the themes of it, talking about the underlying message of it in these last few moments. The great burden of Ecclesiastes is, be sure you have the right values for your life. The knowledge of Christ and the yieldedness to his will. If you follow any values other than those, they will be empty and tedious in time to come. And that really concludes our study. My hope is it will not just be exercised academically about a biblical book, but will be exercised about how our lives can be better lived before God. And in particular, how through the Word of God and trust in God's Spirit, we can be delivered from the setting of false goals and false standards, which so easily lead us to have our minds and attitudes set on the wrong sources and wrong points. Yes, says Koheleth, fear God. He who does that will come forth of them all. And deep down in our breaths, we say a silent amen. We say, Lord, let me live my life day by day in the knowledge of Christ, in the respect of God. And let all of my things and all of my education and all of my happy moments, let all of those things be building stones which, in the fear of the Lord, I use to develop life interests that will honor God and be a blessing to others.